morning, everyone. I know it's the last day, so this is really amazing to see such a full crowd. I'm excited. This is great. This is actually more than some of the sessions on the first day. Okay, so what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today, and I really am sad that you'll miss my co-presenter who's actually sick and wasn't able to attend, but we're talking about the work of getting black women's voices into the policy initiative, particularly looking at some work we did in New Jersey. So I'm a professor at the Department of Health and Nutrition Sciences, and my colleague, Elise Zimmerman, is the executive director for the Partnership for Maternal Child Health of Northern New Jersey, which is based in Newark, New Jersey, where some of this work took place. So we have no disclosures to reveal. So when you're looking at healthcare policy and all the factors that influence them, it really is a conglomeration of many different things. So we have the academic voice, we have the legislative voice, we have the legal voice, we have the clinical voice, and we have the voice of the consumers. Bless you. So I think it's really an opportunity for us to further engage the stakeholders that are going to be receiving services and are really the ones that should be at the conversation when we're talking about policy as it relates to reducing infant mortality. So this work, and Elise will definitely have provided a really nice understanding and context, but this is actually follow-up to some work that was done about 20 years ago in the state of New Jersey when we realized that we had a problem around black infant mortality. And so a task force was created to look at the issues and to create some resources and programming. And so this is really a follow-up to see where we've been and what we've been able to sustain over that 20-year period. And we had two main learning objectives of this research, which actually was extensive. We went into 8 counties in northern New Jersey and interviewed about 160 women, asking them about their perceptions and experiences accessing health care with regards to pregnancy and infant mortality, and also their thoughts around policy and the quality of the care that they received. So our main objective, our first objective, was to identify the value of focus groups. So that was what we utilized as a methodology. And using content analysis, really pouring through the results and the data to get a sense of what was out there and what the women felt as an effective tool to capture authentic input from black women regarding their experiences, and also discuss the benefits of incorporating the voices of these women into practices promoting health equity. So how many of people in the audience are familiar with qualitative research, utilize qualitative research as a methodology? Okay, so we're among friends here. And so I really like this quote: qualitative evidence can make use of the narrative form as a powerful means of influencing policy deliberations, setting priorities, and proposing policy solutions by telling persuasive stories that have an emotional hook and intuitive appeal. That's really the best part about qualitative data. It's descriptive in nature, it's rich, and it really captures what's happening in a way that sometimes quantitative will not give you that extra layer of context. And so we really wanted to delve into what the women were experiencing, and we had really great conversations with them. So we know that in the United States there is a history of a distrust in the healthcare providers and the government, and that theme was very salient in our focus groups. And so we know that black Americans are less likely than white Americans to ask their physician questions freely. So what does that really mean? What does freely mean? Well, it could be that the relationship with the provider has not been established, the patient does not feel comfortable, the patient feels rushed. The women really expressed a range of results in this area, feeling like they couldn't talk to their provider, feeling a distance. They are more likely to report believing that their physician will expose them to unnecessary risk, prescribe them experimental medications, not provide them with the best care possible, and be motivated by profit. These women are very astute, and they understand that the more patients you see per hour, the more reimbursements that you're going to get. So they were very clear when they felt that they were getting their time cut short with the provider. Income and health insurance coverage do not modify the relationship between race and trust. And so trust was a very salient theme that came out, or lack of trust. So this additional quote just kind of enforces what we found in another theme with regards to the benefits of strong social support networks and the use of community and just getting a lot of information at the peer level, and the way that African Americans kind of get what they need through the healthcare system without going through the mainstream providers or in supplementing that with mainstream providers' information. So as I said, the main objective of this project was to determine whether the barriers to prenatal and primary care identified over 15 years ago remain the same today. And we conducted 20 focus groups with 161 women and then analyzed the data. So four main themes emerged as a result of this, and we kind of grouped them into non-healthcare systemic barriers, healthcare systemic barriers, the needs of consumers, and the roles of providers. The role of providers. So I really think that this quote captures one of the non-healthcare systemic barriers that is easily fixable. So the availability and the timing of providers when accessing care at a federally qualified health center or at a community health center. So on your paper, when you check in, it says 60 minutes or 30 minutes to wait. But one time I was there for 6 hours. They call you in to do your intake, then they send you back out. You wait, you wait, you wait. Then they call you in, the nurse takes your blood pressure, asks you a couple of questions, they send you back out. You wait, you wait, you wait. Then they come back in and they want to check your uterus or check other things dealing with your pregnancy. It takes that long. So can you imagine if you're trying to do this over the course of your lunch break or you have, you know, a little bit of time and it takes 6 hours, but on your paper it says 30 minutes to 60 minutes. So this is just one of the examples that women expressed frustration, a lack of respect for their time, a lack of acknowledgement of the myriad things that have to be moved around to be able to attend these appointments with regards to children and childcare and transportation and et cetera. So this is one of the barriers that was presented. So another theme was healthcare systemic barriers, and again, going back to that distrust of the medical system, this woman, I remember this focus group in particular, bless you. The last time I took my daughter to the hospital ER, they still had my old, to her previous information on file. It was like, oh, maybe she had to take this test. Maybe. We'll see. So it was more of like, we'll just wait and see without actually doing anything. When I told them I had this new insurance, then all of a sudden everyone's moving. She's getting the test, they're running x-rays, they're doing diagnostics. An hour ago, when they thought she still had the old insurance, it was, we'll see, they were trying to send her home. Now my insurance is different and the level of care she's getting is obviously is different. It shouldn't matter. A sick child is a sick child. So in this particular situation, a woman was very cognizant of how the change in her insurance all of a sudden mediated, and actually her daughter had appendicitis, and it was starting to rupture, and so as we know, if that's not treated in a timely manner, it can be very deadly, and so this is just a success story, if you will, but can you imagine if she had been sent home like originally they were trying to do under the wait-and-see model because they thought she had old or lesser insurance at the time. So the needs of consumers with regards to reducing infant mortality and supporting women who are pregnant, we asked a lot of questions about social support and who the women had to lean on. So this first quote, during my first pregnancy, my support system was my mother and my daughter's father. He was very good. He was very supportive, and he did what he could financially. My husband was very supportive. He attended all of the visits with me, and he actually experienced the morning sickness for me. I remember that because the woman was talking about how it was so weird. Her husband was throwing up and sleeping all the time, and so that, so, you know, they really expressed a lot of pride and a lot of strength in this area about social support and having strong family networks to help them navigate pregnancies. So we talked about the role of the medical provider themselves and what role do they play at the policy level and at really the individual level with regards to infant mortality. So this quote is particularly stood out to us. I prefer a black physician to have someone to connect with. any time where there has not that has not been the case, I felt like I had to lead in with my resume. Oh, I went to such and such university. I have a master's. I have XYZ. And I had to, whether I understood all the information or not, just fight for my respect to have the same experience as other people that may be in that office. So the women really understood issues about classism and racism and the disconnect with providers and how they had to authenticate themselves through, oh, I have XYZ education to show the providers I deserve more respect. And we know through the research and we know through previous experiences that there's a level of comfort with black physicians, but I don't think it should just be on black physicians to be culturally competent. I think all providers should be culturally competent, particularly if you're working in federally qualified health centers, you're working in low-income communities. I really think that's even more of an opportunity. And so the women really expressed a disdain for not everyone. They definitely had a lot of success stories and great relationships with providers. And so this was not generalizable across the entire project, but there was definitely a sentiment of having a lack of a great relationship with most of the providers that they came into contact with. So what does this mean for policy? Well, as a result of this, we reported all the information back to the state, and we had a stakeholder meeting where we disseminated the results to the federally qualified health center staff and directors and the New Jersey Department of Health, which funded the initiative. And so we came up with a list of proposed interventions at the policy level based on what we found. So, my check is supposed to be at the end, but resource centers within each county where women can retrieve information. So, if you know anything about the landscape of northern New Jersey, it's very diverse with regards to rural versus urban, income, race. And so, we wanted to have county-specific resources for the women. They reported just a lack of specificity in where they got their information from. And so, things that may be relevant for a woman in Essex County may not be relevant for a woman in Sussex County and vice versa. County-specific education and medical resources, we were able to achieve that. We weren't able to get an infant mortality task force together. New Jersey is a very interesting state to do infant mortality work in, and so this is something we're still working on, but we haven't achieved it as of yet. Dedicated black infant mortality resources, having a centralized place for women to get access to resources, having a warm line they can call into, ensure OBGYN communication to primary health care providers. Some women presented with high-risk pregnancies, and so they felt a lack of information, and they felt frustrated with, if you have a very severe case and you're at a federally qualified health center, how do you make that transition to an OBGYN, and how do you make sure that that linkage is upheld? Distribution of pamphlets and educational materials on pregnancy-induced illnesses and how to manage chronic diseases. This is an area of further research and work because we found that a lot of the women were also managing multiple comorbidities such as diabetes, hypertension, and all these things interact with their pregnancy. So we definitely have a lot of work to do, but this was the beginning of a great conversation and discourse with the women. And they really appreciated the opportunity to tell their story, to have their voices captured in a way that was respectful of what they brought to the table and in a way that honored them. So that is all I have, and thank you very much. I'll take questions.
Thank you.
you're not crazy. There is a very marked difference. And, you know, the women are also very cognizant of how they're treated. They know if they talk to their friend who has insurance and she's at a different place and they have Medicaid, it's a very open conversation, and there is a very distinct difference. So. You see? Yep. That's how we do healthcare here. Yes. Good morning. Exactly. Thank you for that. I mean, oh, you're welcome. And if I can just respond one second. I think, you know, there are many reasons why people don't value, and that's a whole other conversation. But the short answer I will say is that it takes time to build these relationships, which are based in respect and a mutual understanding. This is all CBPR work. And it's a mutual understanding and honoring of the voices of these women. And so that's why some people are quicker to do surveys, which you can check a box and put in a Likert scale, and you only get a portion of the entire scope of the situation. And, you know, this is the only way that I do work, and this is why I continue to do this work, because I speak for the women. So thank you for that comment. No, there was a very marked difference in the way that they were treated based on their insurance status and based on the geographic location. So, for instance, some of the women who may have come from a low-income community would take the extra step to go to another county, which is more affluent, because they know that the providers in that county are going to assume better things of them. So there was a very marked difference in the way that they were treated based on their insurance status. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Insurance by providers. Okay. Wow. Yeah, bad. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, we have work to do. Yes. Okay, thank you guys.